Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we look at some of the next steps needed to assist the new governments of the Arab Spring countries towards healthier democratic institutions. Richard Soudriette is a native Oklahoman and has been involved with democracy promotion for many years. Currently president of the Center for Diplomacy and Democracy. For 19 years, he was the founding president of the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, which offered technical assistance on elections, rule of law, and governance in numerous countries in Latin America, Central and Eastern Europe, Africa, and Asia. Prior to joining IFES, he served as a chief of staff for then U.S. Congressman Jim Inhofe. He's been director of the U.S. Peace Corps in Paraguay and the Dominican Republic. He's also served as the chief of staff for the mayor of Tulsa. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and from 2006 to 2008, he served on the Secretary of State's Advisory Committee on Democracy Promotion. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last week, and we spoke with him while he was here. Richard Soudriette, welcome back to Tulsa and welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. I'm glad to be here.
It's been a while, and of course you have ties here. You worked in Senator Inhofe's office many years ago, but more recently at the International Foundation for Electoral Systems and now the Center for Diplomacy and Democracy. You spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations on democracy promotion, and certainly in the wave of the last few years, there are some who feel like maybe we've gotten burned in democracy promotion. And with all the new governments in the Middle East out of the Arab Spring, as well as we leave Iraq and Afghanistan, what are some of the important pillars that we need to try to stress these governments as far as setting them on a long-term trend towards what we would recognize as democracy, knowing that it won't happen overnight?
I think one of the most important things to consider is the role the U.S. has played in promoting democracy around the world, and is it something that makes sense, and how does it fit in with our interests? And I think a lot of people, taxpayers and others, raise that question. And I think the bottom line is that it's pretty well proven that a more democratic world is going to be a more peaceful world. My friend Morton Halperin wrote a book on that, actually really documented pretty thoroughly how that overall democracies tend not to fight one another, then ultimately tend to actually do better economically. So I think just from the standpoint of pure self-interest, it's something that we as Americans should support. But frankly, even more importantly, I mean, our whole country is based on a set of values and ideals. And these ideals are ideals that people that I've met in every corner of the globe not only admire, but really long for. And so I think it's important for us to think back over the course of the past 30 years, the role the U.S. has played in really supporting not only democratic revolutions, but even more importantly, supporting the institutionalization of the democratic process. That's why elections are so important, because that's the building block of democracy, and that's where the legitimacy comes from through the ballot box.
Of course, at some point when we have seen elections, we sometimes don't like the results of those elections, and that's been a temptation for the United States over the years.
I agree. We talked a little earlier about the Palestinian elections that took place, I believe it was back in 2006. And one of the problems is that the results don't always come out to suit us. But I think at the end of the day, what we have to keep in mind is we shouldn't be as focused on tying ourselves to a party or to an individual leader, that we should really be thinking in terms of putting the institutions in place. In the case of Palestine, what's interesting is that the Fatah party, which is the one that has supported the rapprochement with Israel, they actually got an actual majority of the vote. But they divided their resources and they ran multiple candidates in races where the Hamas party only ran one candidate. And so actually that's how Hamas wound up taking control initially. I think the U.S. government was too knee-jerk in their reaction, and I think they should have basically tried to work on a more quiet level, because I think eventually it would have sorted itself out. But unfortunately, now we're in a situation where it just doesn't really see like there's any light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, look, I think the goal for the United States is, I think you said, not so much align themselves with a party or individual and support more the institution of democratization. Let that government stand or fall on its own ability to deliver on its promises to its citizens. And even if we don't like the results, our intention should make sure that, well, the process is in place for the people to cast a referendum on the performance of that government down the road.
That's right. And I think that there's more to democracy promotion and assistance than just election support or election administration. And I think that's where the role of the U.S. and other democracies comes in promoting civil society and dialogue with civil society, promoting a free media, because through the media, that's really the way that the light of day is shown on everything that governments do. The rule of law is also another very key element that if you don't have that, then even if you have elections, but the results are fraudulent, if you don't have rule of law, you don't have any way to legally resolve the issue. So people will wind up going back to the battlefield.
Yeah, or the streets, or a level of repression, which we've seen in places like Iran. And so over the last 15 years, we've been very much, our focus has been on creating stable regimes again because of the threat of terrorist activities. Is that activity compatible with democracy building?
Not always. Frankly, in 2009, I was a little bit taken aback, as were a number of my colleagues in the democracy community. And this isn't a partisan viewpoint. It's just basically the observation that for whatever reason, the Obama administration started moving away from democracy promotion. And in fact, the sad thing is for about the first 3 years of the administration, he wouldn't even use the word, and Secretary Clinton also shied away from it. What people found disappointing is that here she was involved with Bill Clinton, who under him, that's when we had the greatest expansion of democracy promotion activities, and then she pulled back. And I think partially because they and people in the administration viewed this as a George Bush policy, and they didn't want to be seen as continuing that. But the bottom line is, as I think the Arab Spring is what really jolted them back to reality, because you couldn't put a lid on it. And a lot of what happened in the Arab Spring, those were seeds that were actually planted during the time of George W. Bush, because he really made democracy a major part of his program in the second administration.
But also, the way that administration sold it to the American public was somewhat unrealistic, though. The idea that we're going to come into, say, Iraq or stabilize Afghanistan, and all of a sudden we're going to have a Western-style democracy. This is a process that's going to take, a lot of scholars think, generations, if ever. And it may never get to that point. It may be something in between a Western-style democracy and what preceded it.
I agree. I think that there have been a lot of expectations that somehow the U.S. was going to come in and try to use a cookie-cutter model that they would adapt to other countries. And in the 20 years that I was working as president of IFAS, I really came to understand that there is no magic formula. The basic principles of democracy and the founding principles of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, for example, they identify the right to vote as a fundamental human right. But in terms of the specifics of the system and the process that is put in place, if these are not homegrown, and if you don't really start with trying to plant seeds to create a culture of democracy, then democracy won't take root. So you have to work on parallel tracks. So in addition to the electoral process, you have to develop functioning and active political parties, and you have to develop functioning civil society.
And in many cases, those seeds take a long time to bear fruit because the people of the region have no working knowledge, unless they've been abroad, to what a system like that even looks like. And also the drawbacks to that system, because things don't often work as efficiently as when one person makes the decisions.
Exactly. And I think there has been a tendency on the part of some of the democracy providers, assistance providers, to try to embrace specific models, like that it has to be Western-style multi-party democracy. My view is, like you just said, you can't just get there overnight. You can't expect it overnight. But at least if you can start encouraging the development, and in some cases of models that already were there, like we did a lot of work in Burundi, for example, in Africa. They already had experiences with local councils, and they used village elders and leaders. But these people didn't just decide things. They literally did have processes of seeking consensus and input in their communities. So when IFA started working in Burundi, one of the very first things we did was to try to tap into that and kind of bring that in to some of the newer civil society institutions, organizations that were created. Because if you don't have some sort of a basis at the really grassroots level, then people aren't going to buy into it. They're not going to really understand. I mean, I was in one country, I was in Mali, where I literally had a person who came up and said, "Well, what is a vote?" She had no idea what it was. And then when I explained that your vote is your say, that you can have a say in how things are run here or who gets elected and whatever, and then she immediately got it and she voted.
Yeah. You mentioned the Burundi model where it is local councils, and I assume it's not an election in the sense that we wouldn't know an election, but people are basically set up to guide the council and to help make the decisions. That will never look like a Western democracy, but can it be just as effective?
I think that can be the basis that could evolve into a parliamentary system, a more recognized...
When you have that idea of consensus, the town meeting sort of thing, when we think of a modern election, we think of an adversarial system.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that doesn't work in certain societies.
It may not. And I mean, we have an example right here in New England. The New England town meeting is a tradition that goes back to the very beginning of the country. And it's the idea of everybody in the community has the right to show up and talk about whatever they want, and the people come together and make decisions as a community. And that happens in a lot of places, Burundi, even Afghanistan. People overlook the fact that there wasn't a national tradition of that type of governance before. But for hundreds and hundreds of years, they have had local councils, and they have more or less followed that same kind of model as in Burundi, a kind of a consensus-based decision-making, so that you just didn't have one person deciding everything.
But I would think in Afghanistan, it was pretty heavily leveraged towards what we've referred to as the warlords, or what other people would say is sort of the tribal elders or leaders of a particular community.
That's correct. And I think that's one of the reasons why that's a starting point. But, you know, ultimately, I think having a system where they have an elected parliament or they have elected officials, that's the way to go. And I think, I mean, when you look at the participation levels in the recent Afghan elections, they've been very high, large numbers of candidates who have run. And now they haven't been without problems, but frankly, you know, there's not many countries in the world that haven't had difficulties, even a few close to home.
Yeah, you're at home.
Yes.
Florida, Ohio. Well, getting back to that initial question of what do we do with these new governments in North Africa, Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, what is our best first step, given that there are probably portions of the population, maybe less so in Tunisia, but certainly in Libya and Egypt, that's going to mistrust what the United States says, and those who will be equally interested? What are our first steps to sort of set the seeds for an eventual democracy that a Western observer would recognize? Because it's going to be a process.
This is one of the points that I discussed during the meeting with the Council on Foreign Relations, and that is that the U.S. has a role to play, a leading role in democracy promotion. And if we're not engaged, then the whole process suffers. But we can't do it alone. We can't be the policeman of the world. And we also basically can't be the sole democracy promoter. because frankly, it's much richer and it has more impact if you can get more countries involved in the process. And so one of the strategies that I think has been effective, the way IFAS works, is we tap into election authorities in countries where we have already worked. And so we try to bring in people from Ghana, or we'll bring in people from Central or Eastern Europe or Asia, whatever. And so in the case of the Middle East, we've tapped a lot of people that we've worked with in countries like Turkey, for example. And sometimes if you have somebody that is there who is seen as an expert but who is not necessarily seen wearing an American hat, the local people may be a little bit more receptive to the type of advice that they're providing. And I think the other thing is that you can't force feed democracy. You can provide a menu of options. You can share information. But at the end of the day, if they don't really buy into it and make the decision, then it's not going to fly. Now, there have been several interesting examples that have occurred. Tunisia has not been without problems, but it was really the first one out of the barrel and the one that kind of triggered the Arab Spring. And I am very confident that even though they're going through a period of instability at the moment, but I think all indications are that I think they will be able to develop a thriving democracy. And even though the Islamic parties may have a predominance there, they also recognize that it's always been more of a secular type state. And so I think that they'll not be as strict as maybe they might be in some other countries. Libya, surprisingly, with all of the turmoil that happened there, the election process went very well. And they actually elected a very secular-oriented government. Now, Egypt is the one that everyone is concerned about. Initially, I was fairly impressed with President Morsi, but he seems now to have been moving back towards his friends of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think it remains to be seen. But there, I think getting the engagement of like-minded people from the region in particular who can come in and basically spread the message about democracy, but maybe if they're not wearing an American hat, folks there might be a little bit more receptive to it.
We have to remember that the Mubarak regime had elections. It was just that it was always structured so nobody but his party could ever win. And in fact, the Morsi's party was oftentimes banned from participating in the election.
I think
that's, you know, if that's the model, you know, when you all of a sudden become power, there's it may not be from Morsi himself, but from the people who he depends on for the leadership are saying, well, this is what Mubarak did. We have to do the same thing. And it's going to just take time for these new models to sink in.
I think so. And I still think the overall indications are he seems to be sensitive to public opinion. And the real issue is how inclusive his government will be.
In the case of Egypt, it's a very large country. It has an educated minority and a very uneducated majority, really, within that's hard to change overnight and getting the nuances of democracy.
But if that one is successful, then I have great hope for the rest, because it's really the center of the Arab world.
Yeah. Well, what about Iraq and Afghanistan? Iraq, where certainly the Shia-backed forces seem to be winning the elections there. Do they have good institutions in place, or is it really set up for one-party rule?
Well, I will say this. I think the Iraqis should be commended for the work that they've done since 2004, really, to put electoral institutions in place that have worked very well and under extremely difficult conditions. IFAS was involved in helping organize the very first post-Saddam elections that took place back in 2005. And those were elections in particular where people literally were told if they went out and tried to vote, they'd be shot, or if they were caught with their finger inked, that they would be shot. But it was amazing. I mean, even with the conflict going on, they had over 75% of the people that turned out in those elections. And it's fallen off a little bit, I think, for the 2009 elections, but I think overall, the Independent Election Commission is the one that runs it. IFAS has been serving there as a basically as a resource, wearing the UN United Nations hat, because we were officially seconded to them. But frankly, the ones that really did it were the Iraqis. And in part, it was because of the security situation. It was impossible for foreigners to really move around the country. So in a way, that was actually a good thing, because it required that the Election Commission itself really had to take the ownership to implement the elections.
Interesting. My guest today is Richard Sudrietta. He's currently the president for the Center for Diplomacy and Democracy. He's the founding president of the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, where he spent, just short of 20 years.
That's right.
And he was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. I know you've spent a lot of time working on electoral systems and creating the foundations of democracies in other countries. You know, in the last few elections, Americans are starting to look to our own electoral systems, you know, the closeness of the vote in 2000 and ongoing problems. On one side says we have voter fraud. The other side says we're restricting the eligible voters. Can you talk about maybe some common sense reforms for the U.S. electoral system?
I'd be pleased to. I was involved after the 2000 election. We had a few hanging chads in Florida. And so as a result of that, IFAS, and I was personally asked to participate with Harvard University on one of the, they had an election reform group. And we also were involved with the election commissions established by President Carter and President Ford. And we helped with formulating the recommendations that ultimately were passed as part of the Help America Vote Act back in 2002. And I think a lot of the changes that came about there were very positive in terms of, you know, introducing the idea of provisional ballots and emphasizing the importance that all the votes should be counted. They shouldn't just be set aside. But I think it was because of that experience that we decided if we were going to be having credibility internationally, we better start working at home. So actually, IFAS has worked in 14 states in the United States, helping secretaries of state offices and state election directors on refining their plans to be able to access funding to modernize election equipment. This was money that was available through the Help America Vote Act, the HAVA. And we also have done a lot of work, like for the developing a poll worker training manual that has been used and adapted all across the U.S. Since I've left IFAS, I've been really taken by two things in this last election. First, there's this debate about electoral identification and whether or not it suppresses turnout or whatever. My view is I don't have any problem at all with voters having to appear at the polling station and provide some form of identification. It's done all over the world. In fact, what's curious is when the Carter Center made their recommendation to the Carter Commission, Bob Pastor, who was at that time representing him, he came out very clearly and called for the use of voter ID on Election Day. Now they kind of have backed away from that a little bit, because I think there's a mistaken idea that somehow that automatically means suppression. I mean, I think if you don't, for some reason, have a driver's license or some other form of ID, then the provision can be made for you to bring a utility bill or something. But if you put the onus on people to have to produce something, then I think it lends integrity to the whole process. The second thing, though, that I think is terrible is, you know, we've got the Curiosity rover running around on Mars detecting life, and we can't even get people in line to vote before midnight. I mean, this last election, I think it was just terrible.
6-7 hour waits. That seems incredible in a country like the United States.
I think there are several remedies. First off, I do think that we need to have more in the way of early voting. It makes a lot of sense. Making the voting systems a little bit more convenient so people can be able to vote ahead of time instead of waiting till the last minute. The other thing is on the voting equipment. We still have a very antiquated system. And part of it is, frankly, there's a lot of anti-technology nuts who think that The only way you can have a legitimate election is using a box with a hole in it and hand counting the votes. Well, I can tell you, I've been in several elections where hand counting ballots, at the very end of the night, you're off by one or two votes. And that didn't make me very popular.
On the other hand, the idea of touchscreen voting where there's no paper trail, that equally could cause problems. I mean,
I think that the best voting systems are ones that do have an audible paper trail. So an optical scan voting system like is used here in Oklahoma, or if you do have an electronic system, if it has a verifiable paper trail, that also gives you the ability to use that as a backup if you have to. But see,
I've always thought the Oklahoma system was pretty good. You had to connect the arrow, and it just seemed like, you know, I'm sure there are people who could show me there are problems with that system, but it seems fairly foolproof in many ways.
See, the key to all this, I think, is whatever system you've got, as long as you have independent testing and certification of the system, so that way you can be 99.9% sure that it's going to function properly and count accurately, then I don't think there's a problem. Because, frankly, most of this is a perception problem. And where it really becomes dicey is if you have a close election. So that's why you have to count, make sure it's as accurate as possible so that people will trust that their vote was counted accurately. And that's what all people are looking for.
What about the idea? We still vote on Tuesdays. Most of the rest of the world, they vote on the weekend, don't they?
They do. I mean, one of the things that I always loved about going to Latin America was they have elections on Sunday, and they're very festive affairs, and people come out, and there's food vendors. And I think it also contributes to kind of lowering the tensions, if you will. People don't seem to be as agitated as if they're just going it and doing it as a mechanical.
Taking off of work, usually, in the United States. I always like the UK version where the candidates stand up together at the end of the night and they announce the vote counts and who wins. You know, I always thought that was interesting.
The other thing that they do in the UK that is interesting is the candidates get up and actually recognize and thank the election returning officer for their role in conducting the election. And frankly, one of the problems I think we have here is nobody pays any attention to election administration until there's a problem like Florida. So very little attention is paid to it. It's better than it used to be, but it still hasn't reached the level of professional training and regard as other disciplines within the field.
Do we need nonpartisan people in charge of that? Because, you know, in Florida, for example, you know, the Secretary of State, I don't think that's always going to be somewhat of a partisan position. But the election supervisors, I know in certain counties they were Democratic people, in certain counties they were Republican people. And that just seems like that casts a shadow over whatever happens in that county. And anything that sort of strays from the usual predictable becomes suspicious.
I mean, actually, that practice is something that in my years with IFAS, we would always actually recommend that people not do that because it automatically raises a red flag. I think election officials, as soon as they take the oath that they're going to run election, they basically need to take off whatever partisan hat they have and put it in the drawer.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It's been an interesting conversation. Richard Soudriette, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rich.
Richard Soudriette is the president of the Center for Diplomacy and Democracy. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations late last week, and we spoke with him while he was in town. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.